Hello, everyone. This is Cassie Burns, co-founder of All Your Data. I'm an attorney who's been using AI and machine learning for 10 years. I love data and love talking to people about data, and that's what this podcast is about. Each episode of Cassie and will feature a new guest. Each guest comes from a different background with a different approach and attitude towards technology. We'll talk about their experiences and hopefully we'll learn a thing or two. Thanks for joining. Let's get started with Cassie and
Chris Moeller. So this is actually an interesting episode of Cassie and. My guest, Chris Moeller, actually invited me to be a podcast guest for his podcast, The Edge Report. And in the spirit of work smarter, not harder, I'm going to use that recording for this episode of Cassie and. So with that, I will let you get to it.
Cassie and I have been friends now for a couple of years. We've been following each other and working together and kind of messing around with each other's content and kind of meeting some new friends. So Cassie, welcome to the show. Thanks for coming.
Thank you. I really appreciate the invite, Chris. We always have great conversations, so you don't have to ask me twice to join.
Yeah, well, thanks. So Cassie, where are you today?
I am in Fort Worth in Texas, the Dallas-Fort Worth area. I work home, so if you hear a dog barking, that would be one of my dogs. Yeah.
We love our fur babies, and Texas is a great spot. For listeners that don't know you, Cassie, tell us a little bit about your professional background so we can set this up.
Yeah, I have been a practicing attorney for 18 years, and I've been in e-discovery, which is this very niche area of litigation that no one's really heard of, but it is our time to shine because we've been using machine learning and AI for over 10 years in our practice. So now with all the broader conversations about AI, we can kind of raise our hands and go, hey, we've been using all of this stuff in an adversarial setting. So we do have to create defensible workflows and we have to validate and we have to use math sometimes. So it's a very exciting time in my own personal career. So yeah, that's what I've been up to.
Cool. Well, you know, I think just to remind you, if you don't remember this, I was in that business, right? So I was always been in commercial real estate, but I started with a small company called Nextra Litigation Solutions doing workplace strategy that then grew up and was acquired by Huron Consulting Group. And so all my old e-discovery friends out there, if anybody's listening, that was 20 years ago that we were talking about technology-assisted review. That was before relativity was out there. And we were really just sort of creating the workplace activity-based design for review attorneys to move from paper to digital, which is why I feel so old.
Yeah, I mean, and it's a great, you know, it's very interesting. We were on the front lines of seeing the legal profession adjust to paper corporate documents to electronic. And that over time got more sophisticated, but the tools we used to tackle that got more sophisticated. Because I remember reviewing documents for anyone who doesn't know, in litigation, both parties have an obligation to exchange documents to the other side to help build their case. It's a process called discovery. And as data sources became more voluminous, so did the burden there. And I remember, you know, before the documents can go to the other side, an attorney for the client has to look at the documents and make sure this is something the other side really needs. And I remember reviewing documents that were, in essence, like a whole image desktop, and it was cached web files, if you can believe it. And over time, we've added layers of sophistication, culling using NIST type of guidance and email threading and near duplicate analysis, and then on to more conceptual index heavy workflows. And now we're, of course, tinkering, testing out generative AI, because we're very well versed in analytics and in AI, machine learning. We've been using it for a while.
It's funny.
You're like
the most progressive tech in like the least progressive industry, right? And that's why people have no idea. I tell them 20 years ago we were working on this stuff because I had to do seating, right? And I had to do workplace strategy for how many reviewers in the next office. So we were like doing market absorption, right? Like we were out there like really building these huge review centers, 200, 400, 500 people. And every time we did it, we would stop and say, what is technology assisted review going to do to that first round? And should we take 50,000 square feet or should we take 25,000 square feet? And here we are 20 years later, right? Mm-hmm. And now AI is everywhere. People are like, oh, that's cool. How does it work?
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of the conversations we heard on the legal side, at least kind of in my little sphere, was, are the robots going to take our jobs? And here we are again, hearing the same thing. And I would say the robot maybe took some jobs, but I would say if you're someone who follows the technology and you stay on top of the technology and you try to make an effort to understand it and be involved in, like, how can we leverage technology to make workflows better where it makes sense, you're pretty much giving yourself job security. I mean, that's what I did. I was a doc review attorney, and I could see very early in my career, and I could see I'm going to follow that technology wherever I can. And it meant that there were times where I wasn't working, you know, as a practicing attorney. I was working as a manager over lit support people for a tech company, so I could learn the tech really well and just to build up my knowledge base. And because I knew, like, that's where your value is really going to come in. But it's so interesting because it is such a weird little niche area. And it's also been a practice of law that's been seen as less sophisticated, which is, and I think some of that comes from, oh, you're just scanning boxes. And while we have increasingly leveraged technology to create efficiencies, the expanding growth of technology and data sources makes our work even more challenging. Like, every year there's some new layer of sophistication, and, you know, whether it's because of collaboration tools, maybe we don't edit and send documents back and forth anymore. We're all collaborating in one document, editing at the same time, or knowing that there are other data sources like Notion and Airtable, and now you add in generative AI. Like, I've been doing a deep dive on what gets retained by Microsoft when you leverage Copilot. And it's a lot of information. FYI, folks, if you're using Copilot at work and you're using it in Edge and engaging online using the Copilot feature instead of just a regular search, those chats back and forth will get retained and saved and potentially collected if you're ever a custodian. And I think, like, that is a little, honestly, for me, it's like, wow, okay, it's a whole new ball game as far as what our expectations are of being aware of potential data sources. So watch out, folks.
So it's funny because from bricks to clicks is the tag for what we're doing here at the Edge Report, right? And the idea of having to be in one place to do your job versus being distributed is one of the three sort of cornerstone of our exploration, right? And it was always interesting to think about how trends would impact occupancy or tenancy. And even in the digital sense of tenancy with trends, you're talking about exchange events, right? So communication events. And that tenancy is the same thing. The residency of your information or the tenancy of your information, all of that's discoverable. Our digital exhaust, mm-hmm. our digital exhaust is massive, right? So let's talk about the social side of ownership of that, right? Like, is it okay for a company to have that? Do we tell our employees? Do employees know? Like, how do we protect them from themselves?
You know, I think we saw a similar thing again back in the old days, back in the aughts, whenever I was doing doc review, and not everyone realized, hey, my email may be watched. And I will say the emails that I read in that time period, it was wild things you would never, you know, that old edict of if you don't want your grandmother to read it, then don't put it in an email. That was something that people didn't all realize right away, because there was, I think, a misconception that email is mine, but it's not. It's the employer's. And I think probably every company has in the onboarding material some level of disclosure of, like, this is email for the purpose of your employment here. It is our email, or at least it will hint at that. And I think that as these enterprise tools become increasingly available in what we do, you know, like that ecosystem of Microsoft is one example, there should be some level of awareness. But I do think, like, training and education is really important. And no one thinks the norm is not your online chat is, or your online searching is potentially going to get retained, and it all gets retained and it all gets collected potentially, and it's not easily bifurcated out. So that's something even us as the professionals, we don't have our arms wrapped around. Like, it's just something that's just kind of popped up, and now we're, some people are starting to talk about it. So I think, in broader thoughts of, I'm a big proponent of, don't do personal stuff on your work laptop if you can avoid it, or your work machine if you can avoid it. And I think that's going to be a theme that should maybe potentially be carried on. And it maybe it's inconvenient to have two laptops or two cell phones, but if you find that your potential privacy is more important, in many cases, what chat you had with Microsoft Edge is not relevant, but it could be really embarrassing, And I just want people to be aware of that. If you don't want someone potentially having access to it, don't. Now, there are some cases where that might be really relevant. A criminal law case, I'm a big fan of Dateline. So, did the husband Google how to, kill my wife? That would be very pertinent, but, or maybe an employment dispute or insider trading or something like that, it could be relevant. But, I think people don't want, people feel like that's like your inner thinking, your inner thought, and maybe even like how you engage with a chat might be embarrassing to people because they may feel like, oh, I feel like an idiot and I don't want people to see, maybe I'm not the best prompt engineer in the world. But I think you're right, like that level of awareness and is it on the company? I think that they're probably doing a good job of it at the very least initially in onboarding paperwork saying, hey, anything you do is subject to potential review or access. And I think also as consumers, we do need to be diligent about what we're using and what we're doing and what anything we do to engage with technology, data is getting created. And you have to assess whether or not, do your own risk assessment, your own comfort level. Is the convenience more important to you maybe than the potential risk? And if not, then you have to evaluate, maybe I don't use that tool or I don't use that tool in this way. So I think that we just have to be a little bit more thoughtful in that regard as consumers. Again, not to say it's all on them necessarily, but I think we just have to self-educate ourselves,
Yeah, consumer awareness. So I wrote down a couple of things when you were saying that, right? Because some of the Web3 concepts that are out there, especially for blockchain, right? There's zero trust, the sovereignty, right? Self-sovereign ID with wallets where our information is our information. And the website's responsibility is to authenticate to us rather than us authenticating to them, which is kind of a cool way of looking at it. And then agency, our own agency over us. So this is kind of one of those sides of social ownership that we're exploring that gets even deeper if we double click on this, is this notion of all of our digital assets, right? So are our ideas and ideation, ideology, are those ours if we share them? And how do we capture those and maybe prove provenance of ideation?
Yeah, and I think that's where blockchain is particularly powerful, the thought of provenance and how do you do that? And, I think that there are a lot of people who are building in this area. I think a great example is the influencer economy or content creators. And under current heavily leveraged systems, the person is not necessarily owning that content, and that's part of the terms and conditions. But will that change over time? I think that there's a lot of interest, and I think there's a lot of opportunity there for people who are creating that content. And I think also on the flip side, we're going to increasingly have AI-generated content published online. And I think that drive towards human created authenticated content is potentially going to be at a premium. Arguably it would be premium content, right? Maybe not always, but I for the most part I see a lot of generative AI created art and I'm like, oh, it kind of looks the same. Now if someone's really good at prompt engineering, that I think is the exception, but I think, you know, just seeing like blogs and things like that. And trust me, I get why people do it. It's a great thing to fun. A, that's how you learn, right?
It's fun.
But I think if we start seeing generative AI created content maybe make the way more in like other social media posts and really to kind of be part of that curated stream of communicating, I think that the eye is going to want to go towards the human created content. And I could be wrong. My husband and I talk about this all the time because he's an artist. He painted that and he's not into technology really at all. Uh-huh. And I think that there is a genericness that comes with some of that content, even in the writing, it kind of has like a vibe to it, you know, sometimes. So I think as more of that content comes online, we're going to want more human created, authenticated platforms or mediums, publications, and blockchain's perfect for that, right? It's a mechanism that helps validate that. And I feel like I could be wrong. I feel like there are even some journalists and newspapers that are kind of going in that direction, right? Where they're proactively authenticating, because the reality is that's the only way, in my opinion, this is my opinion, we will be able to manage that in the long run, because generative AI content, the scalability of it and the potential volume and output that can be created from that is so large that, and then you can't expect the bad actors out there. Yeah, I'm going to definitely self-authenticate and I'm going to have all of those watermarks on there and I'm going to have all that metadata that shows that this is Gen A created. No, that's not going to happen. Yeah. I mean, so
I my newsletter that you clearly have commented on in the past is authenticated. It's on Optimism. So I use Mirror XYZ to write my newsletter. And when I publish, I mint. They're NFT. And as a joke, no one's ever bought one. Like they technically could be purchased because there's a marketplace, but I authenticate them for ideation, for the sole purpose of minting my thoughts, so that if I'm wrong, fine. You know, if I'm not, fine. But if not anything else, I, you know, am staking my thought in the ground so that I can go back to it and see, was I right or was I wrong? And if I change it, everybody can see that I've changed it, right? So I just love that idea of like sort of freezing time in a thought. And then being able to look at and follow that thought in perpetuity on chain.
Yeah, and I think there's a potential great value there for, you know, artists or even let's go back to like an Instagram influencer that's heavily, you know, their genre is like maybe photography, like OG, IG, right? I mean, and I remember there are accounts out there that will, you know, right click copy and just repost other people's photography or content or maybe reshare it or whatever. But if there's a mechanism that allowed people, the originator of that content, to save it on the chain, then you have the potential to down the road be able to say, hey, this image was on the chain first, on this chain first, obvious, you know, in violation of copyright. You know, there's a little bit, you know, potentially more of a way to manage that. Now, that is a cost, of course, to the content creator, but I don't know. I don't think we're really prepared for the level of generative AI that's going to start flooding the internet. And honestly, like, is already there. Like, how much generative AI content has been published online in the past year? It's probably a lot more than we realize. And there have been a lot of studies out there starting to address this fact. As data, you know, as generative AI content gets published on the internet, and if that is the source of LLM training sets, as it continues to pull data off of the internet, what is that going to do to the quality of the LLMs? And so then I think that that's even going to potentially drive better curated training data sets, you know, for LLMs, where there is a level of provenance of this is human created content. This is, you know, maybe we're not so focused on getting so much, but a lot that's good quality. We all talk about garbage in, garbage out. And there are even some protocols being developed right now that are focused on metadata around training data sets. I think that's going to be an important issue that gets raised over, you know, the next year or so. But I love the concept of provenance. I mean, it, you know, whether it's content creation or supply chain, and that's one of my favorite use cases of blockchain. I'm into blockchain, the technology, not so much the cryptocurrency side, more on the provenance creation, are that kind of side of things. So
yeah, the utility layer, the L2s and beyond, right? So, mm-hmm. Well, let's double click on the platform thing for a second, because there's really some timely news that we should talk about. Senate just passed the TikTok ban bill, right, in flying colors, and the Biden administration signed it. So now ByteDance, their parent company, has, I think it was like 8 to 12 months to sell, or else they could potentially face a ban in North America. I have sort of two thoughts on that, right? One, I understand the technology well enough, and I understand surveillance capitalism enough, where I understand that platform is pretty sticky with metadata, with voice profiles, with biologic profiles, with eyes, with sound, all sorts of things. But then as an entrepreneur, excuse me, I also understand that there are millions of people who are influencers or small businesses that have that platform as the backbone of their business. So let's talk about that for a little bit. Like, where are you with TikTok?
I mean, I've gotten on TikTok. I played with it. I don't spend much time on it personally anymore, just because I just don't have a lot of free time. So I have to be very, like, if I have free time, this is a social media platform I'm going to go to. And then this will be, if I have a little bit more free time, it's going to be this. So my primary right now is honestly LinkedIn, because there's a lot of, I think, meaningful conversations. It's a great aggregator of information about the latest on AI laws and things like that. So I personally have not been on it, but, you know, I think that this is a very important thing for anyone who's trying to either make a career out of being a content creator or have a small business that social media site or multiple will heavily leverage their reach and the success of their business. And I think diversifying what platforms you're on is a really important thing. And whether it's because one may completely go away because of, you know, a law that gets passed, or I heard this a lot on Instagram, you know, maybe 8 years ago, oh, the algorithm changed and all my content, my reach is completely tanked and the impact it's having. And I think, you know, that's kind of the power or the carrot, the mirage, hopefully not a mirage, the hope of Web3 is that ideally is something that won't get changed and you have a little bit more control over things. But I think always diversify if you can, you know, don't just stick, because at the end of the day, if you don't own that platform that's hosting, you know, your content and pushing it out, it could go away at any time. And I think anyone who's kind of felt the ebbs and flows of what the algo favors and what it doesn't, or maybe what the public favors. Sometimes it's just like people are going to this one instead of that one, you know? So I think that there's a level of mercurialness to this whole thing that you have to be aware of. So I guess that's my first big thought on that topic.
Well, so it brings me to federated content, right? So like mm-hmm. ActivityPub is a protocol right now that Web3, Mastodon and Threads, and, you know, they're trying to figure out how to make the right next protocol for mm-hmm. interoperability and persistence, right? That's the issue. So if I have 20,000 followers on LinkedIn and that LinkedIn network is also my community, and then something happens where I violate terms of use or whatever, who knows what could happen, right? All of a sudden, I have no access to that. You know, if I had thought about my strategy of writing on a third-party protocol and pushing my content rather than writing my content in LinkedIn natively, then I have agency over my assets, right? That's a mm-hmm. that's my asset. That's my digital work. Right. I would hope that when people go find new folks on LinkedIn or on Instagram or whatever, they look at their content, right? They look at their past posts and they try to get their vibe. So it's interesting to me, again, exploring this from bricks to clicks as social ownership or assets that are in this digital world, right? How we can control our the destiny and agency of our own thought.
So. Yeah, and I think you're right. And I think the challenge is there are people who may want to do that. And I think it's very reasonable and understandable why someone would. But also, you know, some of those platforms, they don't have the same kind of reach, you know? I mean, unfortunately, like, you live and die by the algo. And, so, you know, you've already built up, you know, a connection, a network, and one that you've maybe more heavily fostered. You know, sometimes it's X or Twitter or LinkedIn or Instagram. It's really hard to think, oh, I'm going to have to start all over again, you know, in another platform, because that does take work. It takes time. Right. And I mean, there are tools out there that you can maybe use to help you with that. But I also think those systems don't favor that. If it detects a third party app out there helping you, and also you want to be authentic, or at least I do. I do it all myself. I don't use AI to write any of my content. I do it just because, like, to me, that's important for me, for mine, not, you know, hating on anyone at all, but, and we're all busy. We're all so busy. And then, you know, you have, I think there are a lot of people who don't realize that they're like what a federated social platform is. I have a lot of friends that are skincare, beauty influencers, and it is not on their radar 100%. And a lot of it is like they're already working so hard at doing this many times in their free time. The last thing they want to do is figure out, like, oh, now I have to get this thing called a wallet, and I need to figure out which of the multiples that I need to get involved with, and what is that? You know, the reach is a little bit different. As I, you know, recall, I feel like I tried Mastodon, and I was like, I can't deal with this right now. I need to go. I was on Farcaster. I was on very early days, and
you'll have to send me your handle, because I'm on Farcaster too.
Okay. I need to get like logged back in. I was like a triple digit number, I think, like very low. Yeah. And then I lost track of it, because I just can't manage. At the end of the day, that's the commodity. We do not have enough time. We don't have time. Like, that is what we don't have. And I think, to me, that's the biggest challenge is always with Web3 and blockchain. It's like, it takes a little bit more time to get involved, figure out like what that workflow is like to engage with that type of technology. And I think it probably is getting better, faster, easier, but that like just is one extra thing that keeps people from doing it. I think even if they find out about it, it's just like, oh yeah, I have to do all of these things. And, you know, that's where the convenience tends to win the day a lot of times. So,
let's push on that a little bit and transition from with time being sort of this next topic, right? So part of, you know, I'm in commercial real estate. That's really kind of my industry, although entrepreneurial and more in tech for the industry, not brokerage services, not like construction type stuff. Time is the number one reason that people are citing, you know, resistance to return to office, right? And future of work. And, you know, everybody's saying the same thing. I have kids, I have sick parents, I have pets at home, the commute, you know, parking, all to come in to do a video conference with the same people that are all sitting at home, right? So it's not really that it's not convenient. That's been one narrative or misinformation type thing. It's really about people's time. So how have you seen it at your workplace, right? You're working from home now. Have you seen a shift in on-premise, or, you know, talk to me about your workplace itself?
I think, you know, and I'm a little unique in that I live where we do not have a brick and mortar office. I think we're going to have one open later this year. So I think for my colleagues who do live where there's an office, there has been messaging that, yeah, we want you to come in the office. And I can understand why, because honestly, the best skills I learned was sitting right next to someone and them like from a technical standpoint, me watching what they did in the database, and I'm going to do it, and you're going to look and make sure I did it okay. It just expedites the learning curve a little bit. You know, for me, where I am right now in my career, and most people I work with, I'm not working. You know, if I work with someone that's maybe new to the practice, it's usually not someone who's brand new to work. So I'm not training someone like from like baby steps. I feel very comfortable working from home. I think there are times when having, you know, the in-person meeting where it's everybody in person, I think there's a lot of value that comes from that. But I'm a very hyper-focused person. And I am even finding now that when I do go and maybe work, you know, travel to one of the offices and work there for, you know, a couple of days, I get distracted too easily. I feel very, like, I nearly feel anxious of, like, I'm out of my hyper focus zone, and I just feel like unsettled. And not that I like being around, I'm an introvert, but I do like seeing people. But I do feel like my like I'm out of step or something, you know? So I like that, being able just to, okay, I'm on phone calls. Okay. And now I'm going to get really focused on what I'm doing, and just, it's not great because then I don't do anything in my personal life because I end up just working all the time. But
that is a byproduct. We're all working more, which is crazy. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, I know I'll be the first to admit it. I'm definitely working more, but I'm also working more on and in things that I really, really enjoy. Like mm-hmm. I'm not staying late working on the crap that I used to work on. I'm staying late now working on what I'm calling technology as a practice. I'm practicing a lot of new skills, data skills that I never had, you know, minting skills, programming skills, prompting skills, right? So like, that's part of where all my time has gone. Like I say, God, what time is it? I wake up sort of from my computer, right? And it's because I've been in this haze of education. I've been immersed. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think those of us, like you and I said before we started recording the show, it's like, where's the time, right? Like, I'm working on so many different things and I don't feel like I have any time. And you don't, because you're studying something new and you're learning a new skill and you're doing a job. And then you are all of the things you are to your community, to your family, to your pet, right? All of those things, those are regular hats that don't go away too. So mm-hmm. we're definitely occupying our time more through this kind of stuff.
Yeah. And I think, you know, we're very similarly minded, that there's just such a wellspring of information, and I see it for what it is, at least within my profession and my own career, of this could be, you know, game changing potential, you know? So I feel very invigorated to like get in and do and write and read and learn and talk and all of that stuff. And there are times when I'm like, why am I killing myself? Is anyone listening? Why is this, am I learning enough?
I'm paying attention. If that means
thank you. But you do have that self-doubt of why, every once in a while, why am I kind of killing myself? But it is like that drive. Most of my free time is spent focused on this. And it's not because anyone is telling me I have to do it. I just feel like in my brain, in my soul, like this is the path you need to go on. This is, you need to focus on this. You need to do everything you can. And, you know, if there were a cult leader, I would say it was nearly like my own little cult of tech in my body telling me, you know, to do this. So we'll see where it goes.
There's a book called The Go-Giver, and there's this notion of work having seasons, three seasons. There's the season of surviving, right, which we've all been a part of. There's the season of saving, right, which we've all been a part of, and then there's the season of service. And it's not linear, it's circular, and they're not binary, so you can do all of them at the same time, right? There are certain aspects of my business right now that we are certainly just surviving. And there are certain aspects of my business where I'm compelled to serve, and mm-hmm. I'm doing a lot of, I'm not saving anything. I'm reinvesting every dollar right now. So there's literally no season of saving for Orion Growth right now. We're putting it all back into our innovation lab. We're putting it all back into generative AI technology. You know, we're doing strategic partnerships with developers around the country. So where do you think you are on that journey right now? Are you, where do you think you lean, service or surviving or saving?
I think service and surviving. Like, I think it's both of that. I'm the same. Like, I don't feel like I'm saving too much. It's, you know, it's either within my day-to-day job, whether it, you know, to me, that's probably service, you know, working really hard there. And then, you know, again, the, like the free time, it's, I'm trying to learn everything I can. I, you know, because I do feel like investing in yourself is not ever going to be a bad idea. So I've just signed up for the AI Oxford program just to learn a little bit more about AI as it's presented, you know, from that position, you know, because I do have a very distinct point of view to AI, and I want to make sure I'm not being so much in my little bubble. But mm-hmm. I think, you know, there are many times if I speak, most of the time I, you know, I get asked to speak and my budget from my law firm has already been spent. So I'll pay for that out of my own pocket because I feel like there's benefit to that or, mm-hmm. you know, but yeah, I would say, agree with you. It's definitely kind of oscillating or running concurrently, you know, like a little DJ stand, two records, you know, one's in service and one is in struggle mode, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah. All right. So I've got two more things. One is a question. I'm going to give you three words and you have to tell me which one you sort of identify with the most as yourself. Or do you most identify with being a maverick, a maestro, or a misfit?
Misfit, 100%.
Okay, cool. That's how I categorize all of these podcasts, right? So it'll be Cassie Burns Misfit. And then because I'm studying data, right? It's important to have the right tags. So I want to be able to tag people back where I can do like a whole Misfit series or a whole Maverick series. So thank you for that. So let's shift the conversation a little bit into, like, for the last maybe 10 minutes or so about like this journey that you and I are both sort of on separately together in Web3, right? Mm-hmm. Because there's the now of work, which people are starting to focus on with efficiency, and they're starting to talk about team agreements, which is great. They're starting to talk about the technology of how we work, which is finally moving in the right direction, in my opinion, to how, not where. But then there's this future of work. It seems like everybody on LinkedIn is a futurist. And it seems like everybody's a workplace strategist. And it seems like they went from metaverse to AI, right? And then back to metaverse and back to AI. Let's talk about Web3 a little bit. Like, how did you find Web3? Like, where did that start? Do you remember?
I just knew there was a period where I think it was just learning about blockchain because I was very interested in the blockchain technology. And I started pulling that thread a little bit and I joined the Boys Club Discord server and probably 3 years ago now. Uh-huh. And for me, that was the gateway drug of Web3 for me. Boys Club is a social group and media company that is centered in a Discord server, and it's really to get more women and non-binary people involved in Web3, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's just really where I learned a lot, you know, a lot of it's just like reading the posts, learning so much. And I think because I really, the utility around blockchain and Web3 and provenance and ownership and all of that really is something that I found very appealing I have a lot of, my husband's an artist. I have a lot of friends who are artists and creators, and like the potential there I think is great. So it's just something that immediately like caught my fancy.
Yeah, I love that. So we need more, you know, more of everything. I'm a huge fan right now of ESG models, specifically the social side of ESG, not the geopolitical side of trees and plastics, although that's super important. But one thing that I am noticing is that through that social side with employee resource groups, there's just not enough diversity in really anything we do. Right. Mm-hmm. So women in tech, probably the worst. Women in Web3, like unheard of. Right. So I love to shine a spotlight on what I like to call badass mama jammas that are in Web3, right? And I think Denise Browder is one in Workplace. Dr. Fisher from NYU, I think I told her she was a badass mama jamma. Mm-hmm. Rowena came in and stood up on our metaverse table and danced on the boardroom table as an avatar. She's a badass mama jamma. So I just wanted to take a second and tell you that I so appreciate that you're doing what you're doing, because diversity of thought is the creation behind innovation. And it's very hard when it's a room full of people that look a lot like me to get really creative thought.
Well, and this is what I really think. I don't think it's that there's not a lot of women in tech or women in Web3. I think that there are, not as much as I would like, of course. I just think that they're not as inclined to put themselves out there and be as visible out there in social media. And I think it's because of whatever you want to call it, insecurity, imposter syndrome. There's something about us that often, you know, I mean, just talking very broadly, like, don't say that. You need to be the expert of it before you can talk about it. You need to, you know, who are you to think you should be out there talking about it? And there's a lot of self-inhibition of, we're our own worst enemies in a lot of way. But I think in eDiscovery, there are a ton of brilliant women working in eDiscovery, which is very well suited to transition into AI governance. And I think, you know, even in just the computer, you know, who was integral in building up, you know, computer and technology and just programming, there were a lot of women that worked the backbone. I mean, the first computers were really women, right? It wasn't a machine computer. It was a human computers, which tended to be women. So I think that it's nearly like a dialogue that's been allowed to continue. And because certain people are able to kind of get in that spotlight, whether because they don't have that natural inhibition or whatever, I just think that there are a lot of brilliant women working in these areas. And maybe that's what we should be focusing on. Like, we really should be focusing on finding them, because they're out there. I firmly believe it. So I don't know, maybe you see it differently, you know, just being on the front line and, like, you know, finding people, you know, for employment and things like that. But that's maybe my over idealistic, you know, point of view. But
and it's so appreciated, and I think that it really does depend on which lens you're looking through, right? The developer side, the front end side, the back end, you know, like, where are you working in the industry? There are certainly a bunch of really amazing women that are working on the marketing side for sure, but I just don't come across enough people that are building in the back that have, like, because that's where so much more innovation is required, so much more creativity is needed, because we're talking about open sourcing things, we're talking about globalizing and federating things, and it's like you can only do so good of a job trying to make it egalitarian or global if you only have one type of person in the room. So that can be a really big struggle for us developmentally.
Well, and I think, you know, I was at a Web3 based companies conference this week, and, you know, some of the conversation was about, like, completely anti-censorship, which I agree with largely in spirit. But, you know, we had a conversation last year about ordinals, and what happens if someone mints an ordinal and it's a generative AI image of a woman that's a non-consensual sexual image of that person, and it's on Bitcoin. What happens, you know, what do we do in that situation? What do we do if someone puts PII on there and they live in a jurisdiction that has the right to be forgotten? You know, how are we reconciling that? Because there are bad actors out there. There's a certain level of idealism that's happening in Web3 that I think that's especially where the diversity is important, because yes, I agree at principle. I am not a fan of censorship. Don't ban books. I'll let people read what they want to read. But there are a lot of ways where certain, you know, people do get targeted, and it continues to potentially, you know, stop those voices. If, you know, what if female leaders get targeted by people out there that's going to create a bunch of Gen AI corn of them, in essence, you know, I mean, to try and shut them up or try to dampen their voices, you know, what those kinds of things and considerations should be put in, you know, should be addressed, right?
Especially when you're building those systems. And that's what I mean. Like, you can't build a system that's defensible if you don't have perspective, all perspective. Mm-hmm. Right. So it's an interesting time out there. Well, listen, Cassie, this is 45 minutes. My metrics tell me that 45 minutes is the right number. So we're going to have to do another one.
Yes.
Which will now be like, I've been on your show. You've been on my show. We talked about ordinals and Bitcoin. This time we did bricks to clicks for the Edge Report, talking about sort of some of the social IP. I really enjoyed this conversation, and I really do appreciate you taking the one resource that we don't have enough of and sharing it with me.
Anytime, Chris, anytime. You just have to ask.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Cassie.
Bye.
Bye.